on the topic or the topics that I offered reflections on, or and just the process of the practice has unfolded for you. Whatever comes to mind. And we can see this as a part of our practice by remaining present and in contact. And then after, we'll sit just a few more minutes and offer the sharing of merit before our closing circle. Yeah, equanimity, along with metta, are two of the paramis that can be a practice directly, meaning that all that's wholesome associated with the awakening process arises spontaneously in our practice. And we become more conscious and we become more engaging of that which is wholesome. And the parami of metta and the parami of equanimity can be directly cultivated as concentration practices. So they are unique amongst the Brahma-viharas. So they're not just contemplations, not just wholesome factors that arise spontaneously, but can be taken on as practices in and of themselves. Equanimity is sometimes looked at as the karma practice. And it's practiced with the understanding that we are the heirs of every aspect, of every aspect of our conditioning that exists, that what exists in this moment, wholesome and unwholesome, is the result of past causes that cannot be changed. So, to the degree that one is aligned with that truth, that one is the heir, one is the owner, one is the guardian, only one can be responsible, then one can concentrate that actually into different stages of samadhi. Yeah, and it's a counteractive process to attachment and clinging and craving. Very, very powerfully effective in relaxing those conditions. And I actually teach retreats that are just upeka retreats or just metta retreats or all four retreats or, you know, as actual objects, Dharma objects of cultivation.
Okay. I've been working today with patients and I've gotten some good understanding in a couple of ongoing situations where I've been, I now realize just been clinging and desiring to make it into something. I was trying to make a friendship into a family kind of thing.
I'm sorry. Let me get clear. This is your preoccupation in the practice today, or you're just seeing that this is a situation in your life?
No. I've been working on patience. Okay. And this person I've been trying to make fit into this kind of notion of what I wanted the relationship to be in terms of creating family or something.
Right.
I end up very impatient all the time with this person and end up my own self suffering a great deal because I don't get what I want and I probably make the other person miserable sometimes. So anyway, just kind of going, instead of going after that kind of elusive thing. You know, if I just maybe to start with the simple intention of practicing patience.
Yes.
Patience.
Yes.
And whatever happens.
Yes.
And then kind of looking at it in a bigger way, I started to see how patience or impatience, the lack of patience, is really interfering with my intentions a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so is there anything specific you might say for me to kind of grab hold even better how to work with
it? Well, I would suggest not grabbing hold.
Okay.
Yeah, but all aspects of the Buddha's teachings, and specifically the paramis, are forces of clarification and purification. Purification is a very important consideration. We don't get much clarification around it because it just isn't interesting to the Western mind. But purification is basically distilling that which is suffering through insight. So as an example, to see that patience relaxes the grasping and clinging to the desire to have this person function for you in a particular way is huge. And the implications, though, are not necessarily yet agreed to, which is letting go. Now, what would you be letting go of? You'd be letting go of using craving as a basis for your perception of relationship. Because I think that perhaps we've begun to see, although we may not yet be willing to work with this, what we see, because it isn't guaranteed that we choose to be clear, even though there's clarity. Mm-hmm. To choose to be clear is a completely different matter of integrity in the practice. And there can be a lot of clarity, and we can still choose to preoccupy our minds with that which hurts and leads to confusion and suffering. And that's kind of one of the strange aspects of practice, because it's a choice-oriented process. So things get clearer, more balanced, as there's more calm, as there's more a sense of embodiment. That can be overridden at any moment by the clinging, craving mind. So you have a choice. And that is, patience has revealed that it's possible just to let things be. And that the source of the suffering is the wanting. And wanting never gets what wanting wants. Never. I mean, it might think it has it. I've nailed it. Here it is. But then it morphs into something else, and it also morphs back into wanting, because wanting is insatiable. So the desire that comes from wanting, and the dreaming that comes, and the kind of view of somebody else from that point of view, is completely and totally and absolutely manipulative. That means that there's an underlying agenda. But that doesn't mean that we, having seen this, don't continue. So it's a matter of choice. So in a certain way, it's already clear. I don't have to offer any more clarity. You've seen that this is attachment. You've seen that a wanting cannot be satisfied. And you've seen that the option here associated with peace of mind, integrity of mind, that integral sense, is letting this person be who this individual is without any kind of projection. And that means that the wanting has to be satisfied with just being present. That means that this person might go away. This person, you know, might become completely the opposite of what it is that you dream this person to be. Don't know. But trying to control things that way is building up a structure that is absolutely subject to disillusionment, dissolving away, disillusionment, disenchantment.
Thank you.
Yes? Isn't that funny that we don't choose the free freedom that arises out of the practice. Isn't it funny? Funny. You know, that we don't choose the calm that arises. It's interesting, right?
It's like there's always something inside that's fighting.
It's fighting.
I'll speak for myself.
Okay.
That we don't choose the calmness, that we're always up against some kind of tension.
Yes.
You know, like yes. I picked wisdom, but what I kept noticing today was what you were just sharing with Tisca was that craving and that wanting.
Yeah.
It was just unbelievable. It was all day.
Yeah. Well, that's the role of wisdom, to help you to see that.
Ah.
Yeah. And to recognize that there's a difference between your seeing it and the seeing itself, which is purifying. Yeah. So the wisdom is that sword. Do we have a magician here with a sword? You know, that cuts through illusion and helps us to see. And this is, again, it's very hard to take this in. But that all the teachings are organized around the truth of suffering. So here it is. It's only by literally allowing objective consciousness to reveal, you know, the process, the actual craving itself and the process of it, how it feels, how it functions, how it thinks, you know, how it animates. For it to actually come into degrees of cessation. Faith is really important here because there's still the belief that craving is the protective force of our existence. Right? There's a belief. And so patience over a long period of time with the underlying beliefs, because this is the very core of our existence, this craving. We're born of it. Like a kind of, you know, two craving beings come together and create another craving being. And it's like, what's the problem? You know, it's like cause and effect. And, I mean, people don't come together out of anything other than craving. I mean, it's not a judgment. I have 5 children. And you know, so I have, as a craving being, beget 5 other craving beings. You know, as a yogi who also happens to be a layperson, who also happens to be a mother, you know, it's like, oh, there it is. You know, right there, it's that sucking energy that says, I need to consume the universe. You know, I need to take it in order to survive. I need to be held. I need to be warm. I need to be cooler, not quite so warm. You know, that whole thing. And it gets so sophisticated. So if you got to see it just objectively, then that would be very auspicious.
I don't know if I saw it objectively. I just know that I started playing games in my mind as to how to fix it.
Oh.
And well, then I had to keep dropping it, and then my mind would start creating ways to fix it.
Yes.
Ways to play with it. I have a little stash of money and I want certain things, you know, and I got this list and I've had these projects going on. There's this whole thing, right? So I'm watching all of this stuff happening and I'm going,
yeah. Well, yeah, now that would be objective consciousness. Seeing that degree of seeing is not self. It's just reflecting a process. It's seeing into it. Yeah. Yeah, so that would be, you know, what would be referred to here as objectification, seeing, it kind of unfolding right before your very eyes. And then also seeing, now what you're trying to fix is the tension. You know, and that tension is, oh gosh, this is really hard. Because we live in duality. That's our karma. We live in duality. And the tension exists in duality between the opposites. And that tension is actually the basis from which intention arises. And in actuality, and attention also arises. And we think that somehow we're going to get rid of it. But it's never going to go away. It's always going to become the basis for inspiration for the Dhamma. It's, that tension is not going to break. You know, it's... Now, when the mind is in a non-dual state, which is another topic altogether, you know, then it feels relaxed, and there are certain qualities that can be cultivated, but not necessarily, again, maintained. But those qualities are purifying and clarifying. Yeah. So in a certain way, when I talked earlier about a non-adversarial view, loving our experience, so to speak, opening to it with affection, means that tension as well, because we're constantly using it to kind of work out the experience, the experiment that we're engaged in, having to do with, there's something wrong and I have to fix it. I can feel there's something wrong and I have to fix it. Fix it, fix it, fix it. You know. So you got that clarified as well. To some degree.
Yeah, because that's what also arose, was that it will always be like this. But that craving is there, and that's just...
It just is.
It just is.
It just is.
I mean, I've been aware of this for years, but as I practice, it gets deeper and deeper, just the awareness of it. And
yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes you're right up against that really hard part of the river where the rock is and the water's really pushing. You know what I'm saying? You
mm-hmm. can... Up against a rock and a hard place.
Just that tension. Yeah, just that tension.
Yeah, and that tension, when it gets strong, is not something that can be resolved. To open to it with that mind, that equanimity of business. Yeah, there's not something wrong if that tension becomes clearly discerned, felt. It's kinesthetically. Kinesthetically known through Vedana or sensation. Yeah, there's not something wrong. It's just becoming, you know, it's introducing itself as a factor of the truth of suffering. And suffering introducing itself in the practice with that much kind of clarity is actually a result of practice. Yeah, yeah. Whereas we think, oh, we're practice is supposed to become more and more pleasant states, and you know, and it's we're just beginning to understand, and get a little bit clearer about this process in this lifetime. Yes, please.
This whole thing about it in the whole thing.
Whole thing.
I'm sifting through something to that. Really got it. It just came up. I had an incident with a very good friend of mine. It's very practical. We stopped by and had one of those cards for red local restaurants where you go to for your birthday for the two for the price of one. And I couldn't do it because I had other commitments. And
oh darn.
You know that. And an old friend. Yet. I can do this thing, things with other people, but I couldn't do this. Alright, so I just got very angry.
Who's
on
angry?
My part, I
who's
feel
angry?
Okay.
Huh? Who's angry?
Just a friend.
Okay, the friend is angry.
Yeah. And I'm on my part, I feel okay, you know, I was honest and all that type of stuff. But still, it keeps arising, you know, it just. Feel all way. I should have knocked this other thing out or done something else and made room for him. I said, you know, why didn't you call me earlier and stuff? And so it's kind of, it's left me, it's still a residual thing there that's bugging me.
So what's the nature of the bug? You know, it's like, if you're clear that it's bugging you, then what is the reflection there. Do you wish that your friend were not angry?
Yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah, that's a big part of it.
Yeah.
another part is guilty. I feel on my part somewhat guilty.
Yeah.
But on the other part, when I think it through, I shouldn't feel guilty.
Yeah.
It's just an emotion.
Yes. Well, that's why we can work with layers of the mind, because it's reasonable, you know, in your assessment that there's no basis for guilt. The Buddha uses this language. It is reasonable that one is feeling this way because there's the cause for feeling this way. But in this case, there's no cause for feeling guilty. Yeah. But guilt, nonetheless, has emerged of a cause of suffering. Right. And what's helpful is to understand that these causes of suffering exist without reason. So you've reasoned it, all right, but still it exists. And so that's where the Dhamma is really working, is to bring up the unwholesome conditions. Now, this is not an antidote to guilt and the lack of ease in it. You've done something wrong, right? This person's felt angry. But the Buddha suggests that guilt is unnecessary, literally, unnecessary. And that if we look at remorse and say, yes, too bad my friend didn't contact me sooner, you know, then that is effectively enough to dismiss the guilt at a personal level and to just investigate it as a state. Anger makes us nervous. Angry makes us nervous, whether it's somebody else's or ours. And so this would be a cause for metta, to kind of let the anger, just let it be there as a state, and say thank you to its arising, knowing that in a certain way, it doesn't have to do with your friend, but it has to do with the fact that now you've accessed that state. I don't know if that makes any sense. But there's no way of out of it.
There's something working with it.
Okay.
I feel like he's kind of crazy, and I feel he's going to get more crazier.
Okay.
Over the years, and just yeah. Really dying, there's just going to build it in.
Yeah. Yeah. Set boundaries. Set boundaries.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if you say to somebody, hey, what if love to go with you if you called me? But they can't take responsibility for themselves and call you and instead blame you. And if that's a characteristic in the relationship, then we do structure our lives out of compassion for ourselves and others in a way that allows for us to connect with people, others, in ways that are wholesome. And if that's not wholesome for you, then perhaps you have to restructure the relationship a little bit. Yeah.
Okay.
Time for change. Yeah.
I'm feeling angry and guilty and just going on.
Yeah.
You know? And well, there'll be an opportunity in the future to things will lighten themselves. Or,
I don't know.
Or whatever, you know.
I don't know about maybes, but and speculations. But, you know, in terms of us right now, this might be a few levels of how to view this process. Yeah. None of it is easy.
It's life. It's real life.
It's real life, and we're bringing consciousness to it.
Really focusing on my energy, which was great. But it does feel miraculous. sometimes can do so many of those things and pass times and find that they just consume me forever. And
yes.
I just feel really grateful for
yes.
staying with the process.
Yes.
The path to a point where it doesn't take forever.
Yes, that's the efficiency factor. There are 13 qualities that co-arise with sati or mindfulness, mm-hmm. one of which is efficiency. It's efficiency by which the mind is able to see into and work with. And this is working as well with change and impermanence. And even though there's a huge conglomerate of different causes and effects there, you know, everything's subject to impermanence. And things do just, you know, live themselves out. You know, so at that level of turbulence and disturbance, maybe this has lived itself out. Meanwhile, if it arises again, then, you know, you're better able to respond to it. Look at this energy, you know. Yeah.
It's such a pleasure to experience the energy in different ways today.
Yes. Bound. Oh, we're so bound. I think the Buddha was right that we're suffering beings. But I also feel that we're suffering beings who have the good fortune of having heard the Dhamma. You know, and we're beginning to intersect the teachings and applications in a way that really do give us more of a sense of faith and hope. Time. So let's just enjoy the process of moving literally back into our practice as an internal movement of, you know, associated with attention. I don't know if you move your body back into the posture, but if you do, let that be conscious as well. And allow for or invite the quality of attention associated with the cultivation of mindfulness. So that we can attend for a few moments in gratitude.